It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Dr. Charlie Clemens. Dr. Clemens is a distinguished graduate of the Air Force Academy and a distinguished alumnus of the University of Washington School of Community Medicine and Public Health. He is CEO and president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, co-founder of the International Medical Relief Fund, former president of Physicians for Human Rights, as well as past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And he is author of the book Witness to War, of which he was also the subject of an Academy Award-winning documentary of the same name. Charlie, thank you for coming in this morning.
Nice to be back in Seattle.
It's good to have you back. Let me begin and ask you, how is it that a distinguished graduate of the Air Force Academy has somehow morphed into being a outspoken advocate for peace?
Well, I think I was raised with a sense of service, I feel like I'm continuing in that vein today, although my sense of that service to the country has changed. I went to Southeast Asia with all good intentions, and slowly, looking at what I was being asked to do and looking at the deceit and the deception that I was asked to participate in, I began to feel that it was wrong, and finally it reached the point where I felt like I couldn't in good conscience even continue the non-combat role I had. I was a C-130 pilot at that time, and the invasion of Cambodia was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
And so what did you do to disengage yourself from that?
Well, I went to my commander and said I was getting increasingly angry about what I saw around me, what I was being asked to do, and that I was concerned about that. And very shortly, I found myself in a closed, locked psychiatric ward where I stayed for about 9 months, and I was discharged with a 10% mental disability from the U.S. Air Force. I later went to medical school at the University of Washington, and I credit medicine with really helping develop my understanding of social justice issues and progressive thought, and gradually became an activist. And at some point in time, I was an intern in California, taking care of a lot of farm workers in a community called Salinas, and began seeing refugees from El Salvador. And we were sending advisors down there, and then we started sending helicopters down there. It just seemed like another Vietnam was unfolding. I had become a Quaker in the meantime, and Quakers believe in witnessing, and so I decided to go to El Salvador, work as a physician, and see if I couldn't help people understand what was happening there.
And you found the situation there to be pretty similar to what you'd left in Vietnam?
In many respects, I think that the civil war in El Salvador was really about what was happening in El Salvador. It was about years of oppression. It was about death squads. It was not really about Moscow and communism and the Cold War. And I tried to make people aware of that. I worked for a year in an area that became a free fire zone, meaning it was bombed or rocketed or strafed every day by U.S. supplied aircraft at a time when Ronald Reagan was testifying that the Salvadoran troops were respecting human rights in El Salvador. And today, in El Salvador, many of those guerrilla commanders are part of the political process because they have shifted that struggle from a civil war to a political struggle within the legislature of that country and the mayorships and the town councils, and have continued to work on the problems of poverty, but have resolved the issues that led to the civil war.
So you've obviously been working on issues of peace for a while now. What do you feel is the most effective, if one could label that, or more effective ways of grappling with this? Because you had some direct hands-on in these countries, and yet you've also been going out and speaking to others about the situation, as well as with elected leaders.
Well, I think in a democracy, we really have to be well informed, and that's a challenge these days. I think when you look at who owns the media in this country and the kind of messages we're getting from the media, and the fact that the administration often appears to lie and not be challenged by the media, it's really tough to be well informed. And I think that's our primary obligation, and that means seeking out sources of information that we trust and feel are reliable. The internet certainly is a great help in that regard. I think talk radio is a great help in that regard. And I think to be an effective in anything today, in activism, you have to remain well informed.
I was watching a talk that you had done back in 1988 last night, and you were speaking about issues that were happening in Central America at the time. And I was kind of shocked and blown away by the fact of so many of the issues that you were hitting upon then are still true today. In fact, so many of the key players in the administration at the time are back with us today. Have you been shocked to see that happen as well? Well,
it does in some ways seem like a deja vu, and I think that someone had told me in those days that democracy is like old age, it requires maintenance. And I think that sometimes we think because we've achieved something in democratic society that that victory is there to stay. And I think we're learning that for about a decade we've been out-organized and out-messaged and outspent, and we're looking at the consequences of that in many areas.
So, dealing with, again, similar issues from back then, we were talking before we went live that you are currently working on a project that is coming up later this year.
We have a campaign at the UUSC, and our website, by the way, is uusc.org, called Stop Torture Permanently. It's called the Stop Campaign. It is led by Jennifer Harberry, a very courageous lawyer whose husband was a Mayan resistance leader in Guatemala and was tortured to death by a CIA contract officer there. She was successful before 9/11, passing the Harberry Rule, which forbid the CIA, except with permission of the Intelligence Directorate, to hire known torturers and known criminals. That was tossed out the window after 9/11. And we're trying to mount a campaign to stop U.S.-sanctioned torture, to force us to comply with international law, with the treaty obligations, and with domestic law. And as part of that campaign in the fall, we intend to put Donald Rumsfeld, Alberto Gonzalez, and George Tenet on trial in Washington, D.C. It will be a mock trial because we will not be able to apprehend and indict them legally. But the Convention on Torture, the same convention that was used to bring General Pinochet to justice, or the attempt to do so in Spain and London when he was indicted in Spain and then an extradition order written from London where he'd gone for medical care, says that systematic torture is a crime against humanity. And a crime against humanity was really first defined in the Charter of the Court of Nuremberg. And it says a crime against humanity knows no statute of limitations, meaning it could be tried any time. And it enjoys universal jurisdiction. I mean, any court that declares jurisdiction can try a crime against humanity. Clearly, what has been happening at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, Guantanamo in Cuba, and Abu Ghraib in Iraq rises to the level of systematic torture. This is not a few bad apples. This was a systematic plan, many of the orders of which flowed from a higher authority, and therefore is defined as a crime against humanity. And we intend to present that evidence to the American public. We'll stream it on the internet. We hope that people will watch this in community and congregations. In May, we'll be asking communities around the country to create their own indictment ceremonies around this and forward those to us. And on the day devoted to the International Day devoted to the prevention of torture, which is June 26th, we will deliver those indictments in Washington, D.C. So for more details on this, I encourage people to look at the website, uusc.org. And I'm also speaking a couple of times Sunday at the University Unitarian Church on 35th Avenue Northeast. And after the 12:15 service, I'm sorry, the 11:15 service, so that would be about 12:15 or 12:30, there'll be a talk back, a chance to talk to the people who came, and I'll be happy to answer further questions about this.
Well, Sticking on the topic of torture and players that had been heavily involved in Central American policy back in the 80s, what was your take on John Negroponte? He seems to be bouncing around in careers at the moment, moving from being over in Iraq, heading things in Iraq for a very brief period of time, and now being in charge of intelligence here in the U.S.
It was amazing to see that he was nominated to be the czar, perhaps not surprising in some regards. One of the primary programs of the UU Service Committee over the years has been congressional fact-finding missions, and within hours of Jim McDermott being sworn in as a U.S. congressman, we took him to Central America on a fact-finding mission. And I can remember sitting across from Ambassador Negroponte in Honduras and him denying that the Contras were supported by the United States, that they were operating secret bases out of Honduras, and just continuing to lie directly to a U.S. member of Congress. And, of course, we didn't know Iran-Contra was going on at that time because we had made an attempt through the Bolin Amendment to shut down funding for the Contras. We could drive to another part of Honduras and watch the C-130s and other American supply aircraft land from that base. But he was a very, I thought, deceitful man at that time and very aggressive, and I think that that has been rewarded.
Talk about, if you would, I got involved in Central American issues back in the late 80s, and a lot of the people that I was involved with back then no longer appear to be activists anymore. At least they aren't out in public and doing the incredible work that they were back then. Seems like there's a really high rate of burnout, and you've been working these issues for a long time. How do you maintain your level of energy, and what do you see as solutions to keeping people involved in these issues for the long haul?
You know, I think it's a great question, Mike, and I think one of the most important aspects of this is community, not letting ourselves get isolated. I really think that we have to form community to sustain ourselves in this kind of work and other social justice work. So it's important to feel a part of a community. I also think that we have to celebrate along the way. We have to be able to laugh. We have to be able to look at this as not an exception, but this is part of life, you know, that keeping the world from going astray is something that we want to pass on to our children, and we need to model it for them. So I think that that's an important part of it. I also think it's important to kind of really understand that there are many, many different roles to be played, and some of them are very public, and some of them are private, some of them are small, and some of them are large. I look at this indictment of General Pinochet, the former president of Chile, and I want to go back to that just a little bit, because Chile signed the Convention on Torture in the late 1980s. They continued to torture, to kill, to disappear without regard to this international treaty they had signed. A judge in Spain was outraged by that, and noticing that the convention said that systematic torture was a crime against humanity, and Pinochet had let 3 out of 4 torture victims live. So there were maybe 30,000 of them in Cuba. In Chile, and many of them had gone to Spain in exile, where the judge became familiar with them. He had let them live so that they would spread the fear and the terror about what's happening in the jail cells in Chile. And the judge decided to indict him because systematic torture was a crime against humanity, and he could declare jurisdiction in his court in Spain when Pinochet, and then he wrote the indictment and kept it secret, didn't make it public. And then Pinochet went to London for medical treatment, and he was greeted in the airport in Heathrow by Maggie Thatcher, who was by that time out of office but a dear friend of his, and they met in a private lounge and had tea upon his arrival there. And the person who served that tea was so outraged that this Chilean torturer was being feted by Maggie Thatcher, left work that day and went down to the Guardian and said, "There is a torturer in our midst, and we don't know where he is, but he is here for medical care." And the Guardian ran that headline the next day: "There's a torturer in our midst." The aides to the judge in Spain picked up on that. He called London Yard and read them his extradition order, and Scotland Yard was obliged to go and arrest the general. He was under house arrest for a year as this case worked its way up into the courts to the highest authority of that land, the court of the House of Lords, that finally ruled it was a legal indictment and a legal extradition order. The hero of this whole thing, or the heroine, is that person who served tea in the airport that was outraged by what they saw and decided to tell somebody about it. So we never know how important our role is going to be, but I think we have to understand that history is written by the kind of collective effort of many people of a generation, and that understanding that we all play a role and have to feel that it's going to make a difference. And if it doesn't, it keeps us honest and it restores our integrity. And that's a terribly important part of this whole process as well, is that we do this because it's the right thing to do. We hope we'll be successful, but who knows? And I think that the Pinochet is a good example of it. The courts in Chile were embarrassed. Pinochet was allowed to return home because of a medical condition. His retainer said that he had suffered a series of strokes and was incompetent to stand trial. Three physicians were appointed by the House of Lords to examine him. Two out of three agreed with them, and he was allowed to return to Chile on humanitarian grounds. But the courts in Chile were embarrassed that a court in Spain had to declare jurisdiction. And activists in Chile continued to indict him, and finally the court stripped him of the lifetime immunity he had granted himself in Chile, indicted him. He has since been placed under house arrest. He tried the same ruse again, because when he returned to Chile, when that plane landed at Valparaiso and the red carpet rolled out, you know, he stood in the door and saluted. He was not confined to a wheelchair and drooling, continued to be proud of how he had escaped justice. And three more physicians were appointed by the Supreme Court in Chile to examine him. Two said that he should not be brought to trial. The judge said, baloney, this man is going to stand trial. Justice has been very slow, but the arc of the universe does bend toward justice. And we have to remember, it takes people to bend it. It doesn't bend by gravity. Martin Luther King made that statement famous, but it was Theodore Parker, a Unitarian minister in Boston in the 1850s, who was part of the opposition to slavery, who urged opposition to the Boston Fugitive Slave Act. So while others were using scripture to justify capturing slaves, he was defying that act, and he died before he saw much progress toward slavery. But it was Theodore Parker who told us the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And we have to believe that as activists, I think. It sustains me in the difficult periods, because you never know if that curve is on the way up, if you're at its apex, or it's on its way down.
Well, I know from the progress that's been made with bringing Pinochet to justice that people like Henry Kissinger aren't venturing very far from their doorstep anymore as well.
The New York Times, in honor of Pinochet, coined a new verb in 1999. He was arrested in 1998. This ruling of the Court of the House of Lords was announced in 1999. And the New York Times said that thugs and dictators around the world hesitated to travel for fear they would be Pinocheted. And so Pinochet may never be convicted in a court of law, but the spotlight of history has been shown upon him, and I think he has been memorialized by this new verb that the New York Times has coined in his honor.
And we've seen with the situation in Abu Ghraib that some the people who were on the facility itself when these tortures occurred have been punished to a degree, or they've been sentenced, but I know there was a call, even within, by Congress members, that the entire chain of command needs to be followed all the way to the top on that. Do you? And of course, you're having your trial coming up here. Now, is that in June?
That's in September.
September.
So the we're going to ask congregations around the country and activist groups and interfaith groups to prepare indictment ceremonies in May and to publicly indict these three men. As I said, they'll forward those to us, and on the International Day Devoted to Prevent Torture, June 26th in Washington, D.C., we'll present those indictments, and our trial will take place in mid-September in Washington, D.C.
And how long do you think that will last?
Well, we're going to contain the trial to 4 hours so that people can really, we're going to use the evidence on record already, which is more than sufficient, and really kind of compress that. And they will have defense lawyers defending them using the same defenses that they have used all the way along. But we think that we can present the primary evidence and defense within a 4-hour period of time.
That would seem to me to be a good thing that people could organize around locally, and let's say communities like here in Seattle, where you could get perhaps a venue like a church or something to show that live, and then have people, you know, together to be able to comment on this and you know, work with the results after that.
That's exactly what we hope. We're going to stream this on the internet, and then rather than watching it on individual computers, we hope people will rent a big screen TV and watch it in a group of people and decide what they want to do about this next. And following that, there's going to be a day of lobbying in D.C. for a piece of legislation that will shut down this loophole on torture. And so we hope that activists around the country will respond to this.
All right. What other issues do you see as critical that people need to focus on at this current point in history?
Well, the UU Service Committee has just finished a year-long process of what we call program review and refocus, and we have been in contact with our project partners around the world and with hundreds of our members around the country. And former board members and activists, and we tried to look at what are the issues that are going to affect people's lives in the next 10 years. One of those issues was civil liberties in a post-9/11 world, where the fear of terrorism has been used to curtail civil liberties, and the anti-torture campaign is a direct outcome of that. Another one is that we're going to be defending the human right to water around the world. There has been a fairly quiet but significant shift toward privatization of water to create a commodity out of water. Enron was aggressively buying up water companies before it went out of business because it understood if it controlled the spigot like it did the electricity in California, there are billions or trillions of dollars to be made. So we intend to enter that fray full force. And our third program area is going to be economic justice, where we're looking at issues of living wages, of fair trade, of labor rights, and really trying to protect and stand with people who are left vulnerable by these trade agreements that really strip us of our ability to make decisions in communities.
Yeah, the privatization of water is a key issue, and I can't remember the specific country in South America that was successful in regaining their rights on that.
Cochabamba, Bolivia, where Bechtel had been granted, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank has been doing something parallel to what the Bush administration has been doing at home. They have been denying loans to municipalities and cities that want to refurbish their aging water and wastewater systems. That happened in Bolivia. They were forced to privatize. Bechtel was given the contract to come in and run their water system for 25 years. And Bechtel, within short time, tripled the water prices, but also began to claim that the rainwater which fell and was collected belonged to them and the water in wells. This outraged the indigenous people of Cochabamba, for whom that had been part of the common, part of what everybody shared for years. And they rebelled, and a small civil war resulted, actually led by a cobbler, a very humble man who led this increasingly active and civic and widespread opposition to Bechtel. And Bechtel had to leave with its tail between its legs, but it's now suing Bolivia for, I think, $25 million in lost profits. Actually, the amount may be far more than that. But this is the issue that we intend to be engaged with, and it's happening in the United States. Many, many communities are facing this. It's being done behind closed doors. A small community in Massachusetts recently, Lawrence, there have been 18 behind-closed-doors meetings of the city council attempting to sell the water system to a private vendor before people discovered what was going on and put a stop to it. But it's happening in many places in the United States as well as abroad.
I know in Washington State there's, I believe, 8 municipalities now that have taken their public water facilities and sold them to a private firm. The last one I read about was, I believe, over in Sunnyside or Sunnydale that sold theirs to a Texas corporation. So it's coming to a community near you.
And, you know, there are some cases where privatization may make sense, but what we urge communities to do is to contract out the management of it, not to sell their water system and entirely. And there are some real horror stories about what has happened to some of these communities that have done this. Detroit tried it, and it totally blew up in their face there. Atlanta had a very bad experience and backed away from there, as New Orleans is another place where it almost happened. So there are some real horror stories, and communities really need to understand the consequences of these actions and to retain their right of stewardship. This is an inherent right of communities to protect their water supply for the future and not to sell it because they need some quick capital to fix up an aging system.
The other issue you mentioned, which is pretty wide, is economic justice. Do you see the current state of affairs? I mean, here in the United States, where it seems like the chickens are finally coming home to roost, we're watching our own economy crumble before our very eyes. And do you think that in a lot of ways that the policies that we have been sending overseas for years are finally going to land here and open Americans' eyes to the problems with those very policies?
Well, I think that people are beginning to wake up to some of the consequences of this, but I think the process has really just begun in some ways. If this general agreement on trade and tariffs is passed, that has been debated, and a lot of this taking place behind closed doors, is successful, it's going to accelerate this what we call rush to the bottom, where capital and labor goes to the areas that are least protected, that have no labor protections to speak of, and no environmental protections to speak of, and you know, we're having to compete with places that pay 13 cents an hour compared to working here. So I think that these are complex issues, and unfortunately they're not black and white, but people really do need to become conversant and involved in these issues, because I think that there are many ways to address this, and we need to kind of ratchet up the level of our involvement.
And like you pointed out with the two examples, the woman that alerted people to Pinochet being there in the UK, and the cobbler that led the movement for getting back the public water, you never really know, you know, what your contribution is going to do on the big scale of things, but obviously it all adds up.
And we have to believe that, you know, we have to believe that we're making a difference, whatever our role is in these struggles.
All right. Well, what final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with?
You know, I got back into full-time human rights work when I went on an emergency public health mission to Iraq a couple of years ago. I have been helping communities in the southwestern United States that were without running water and sewer, and there's a lot of those so-called colonies along the border. And I was pretty discouraged by what I'd encountered in Iraq and the deception, and the war had actually already begun in many ways. We'd be driving through Iraq, and a building would suddenly blow up, and it had been a missile launch from 35,000 feet that was destroying a telecommunications exchange, because we were systematically destroying their ability to communicate before the war started. And lamenting about this from an internet cafe in Baghdad, someone from Israel sent me something from the Talmud, and it said, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justice now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it." And I think it's a good thing to keep in mind, that we're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are we free to abandon it.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
We have just been speaking with Dr. Charlie Clements. He is author of the book Witness to War and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, as well as Physicians for Human Rights.